Economicbuzz.com.
This is the morning brief from the Economic Times.
India's alcoholic beverages industry is the world's third largest, pegged at an estimated $35 billion annually. And among spirits, India shares an immense love affair with whiskey. It is the most consumed spirit in India, and we are also the world's largest producer and consumer of whiskey. But Indian whiskey has for long been derided as not being whiskey at all. The reason for this is that most Indian whiskey is made from the neutral spirit manufactured using molasses, which is a byproduct of the sugar industry. Globally, what is considered whiskey is made from a mash of fermented grain. And therefore, India is not a particularly noted destination on the global map of great whiskies. That is the reason a development from last week has surprised the rarefied world of fine whiskey. From the Economic Times, I'm Shrudijit, and this is the Morning Brief. Paul John Mithuna. That is the name of a Goa-made single malt, which has been ranked by the Jim Murray's Whiskey Bible as the world's third best this year. It's an honor that Bangalore-made Amrit Fusion achieved in 2009. At one level, this represents a broader trend of premiumization in India's alcoholic beverages market. But at another, it's an astonishing feat for an Indian whiskey to be ranked among the best in the world from a field filled with so many prestigious distilleries from so many countries with a long tradition of fine whiskey making. As luck would have it, one of ET's feature writers and one of India's top writers on food and drink, Vikram Doctor, now lives in Goa and visited John Distilleries and spoke with their master distiller. I invited Vikram to join us on the podcast and discuss this development and its implications. Vikram, thanks so much for joining us. You visited John Distilleries shortly after their Mithuna single malt hit the headlines globally. Could you take us through what you saw there and also tell us what this development means for Indian whiskey?
Hi, Shrutijit. Yes, I went to visit the Paul John Distillery the same week that their new whiskey, Mithuna, was awarded the third best whiskey in the world by the Jim Murray Whiskey Bible for 2021. This is really quite an honor. Jim Murray, every year, lists whiskies across the world, from around the world, from different types of whiskies, and he comes up with his whiskey rankings, which are very controversial, but they're very highly regarded. And in 2010, for the first time, he gave an Indian single malt, Amrit Fusion, the third best whiskey in the world, which was really path-breaking. Nobody in the whiskey world had ever really taken Indian whiskey seriously up to then. Right. The joke was always that, you know, Indian whiskey is basically scotch-flavored rum, because most Indian whiskey is IMFL, which means it's made with extra-neutral alcohol, which in India is always distilled from molasses. And so basically you have this, flavorless alcohol to which you add various flavorings, usually different types of scotch or single malts. And that's what you get, which is, that's Indian whiskeys. And now, you know, in 2021, a new distillery, Paul John, has got the same ranking for its Mithuna whiskey. So I think it shows that high-end Indian whiskey, high-end Indian single malts really are here to stay.
Right. Quite a development to have an Indian whiskey ranked globally among the top whiskies. Could you tell us more about who is the promoter of this distillery? Who is the master distiller? You know, what are its premises like? And how exactly is this award-winning whiskey made?
Yeah, see, again, this is interesting. I mean, you know, when you think of the Indian liquor industry, you think of like these really old companies, like obviously all the Malia companies and all these heritage companies. But actually what people don't really seem to remember is that within the last 10 to 15 years, a whole bunch of new distillers have come up, young people, many of them with roots in the liquor business, but who have set up from scratch and are creating a completely new kind of alcohol in India. And Paul John, which is John Distillers, is a good example. Paul John himself is the son of a big distiller, liquor baron from Karnataka. And they have like mass market liquor brands. They have something called Only Choice Whiskey. They have a brandy brand called Montcastle, I think. And these are all very big mass market brands in South India. But it's not something that, you know, most people know about. And it's certainly not something that has any prestige attached to it. But of course, they're extremely profitable. Right. And what these guys have done, Paul John, is he decided to actually set up something of really high quality. Mm-hmm. And he's invested in this distillery in Goa. Amrut really was a pioneer, and I think Amrut has showed people like him that it's possible. What is really interesting is that the year that Amrut Fusion won in 2010, the top-ranked whiskey in the Jim Murray listings was from this American company called Sazerac. Mm-hmm. And last year, Sazerac, which is also a family-owned company, one of the largest family-owned liquor companies left in the world, took a very large stake in Paul John. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, maybe there's no real connection, but it seems to me that Amrut win in 2010 woke up the whiskey world to the fact that there was potential in India. And, you know, 10 years later, Sazerac takes a stake in the company that achieves the same level that Amrut Fusion had done in 2010.
And how does Paul John make this particular whiskey? Where does the malt come from? Where do the barrels come from? I mean, you had some fascinating details in the piece you wrote for ET Magazine last weekend.
You know, I think that the real pioneers here have actually been the Japanese. I mean, for, you know, decades, I mean, the Scots always made everybody think that the only good Scotch whiskey could actually be made in Scotland. And they gave you this massive mythology about the water and the barley and the peat and, you know, the myth making was considerable, and you know, for decades nobody went beyond that and thought it was possible to make anything good. But right. Sometime in the, I think starting in the 1980s, the Japanese, who always had a large whiskey industry, Suntory being the biggest brand, decided to try and create something of similar quality. And in the process, Japanese whiskey has now got a global stature. It's seen as the equivalent of Scottish whiskey. Absolutely. And I think. And in the process, it's revived the whole Japanese whiskey market. I mean, now, young people see whiskey as something collectible. You know, the whiskey distilleries in Japan produce very limited editions of, you know, just about, say, 10,000 bottles, which are really highly priced and very special with very different finishes. And so it's become a cult item. And that's really worked. And I think very clearly, Paul John and Amrut have taken that lesson on board, that to elevate the status of whiskey in India, which again we see as an uncle's dream, you have to really go high-end. So it's obviously a really interesting strategy that Paul John and Amrut are following. But Paul John did one thing beyond that. They've really gone completely Indian. So the barley, for instance, which, you know, some of these distilleries would import from Scotland earlier, is now grown in India. It's grown in Rajasthan and Haryana. And it is malted, which means it's basically soaked and germinated, because in the process, what happens is the germination turns the starches that are natural in barley into sugars. And that happens in Haryana. And what I found really amusing was that for most of us, when we hear the word malt, we'll think of Bonvita or Horlicks or all these milky drinks that our parents would force us to drink. Actually, it's the same thing. But what happens with Bonvita and Horlicks is obviously you stop at the germination process. And then it's dried and it's made into malt and goes into our Bonvita and Horlicks. The same thing happens, obviously, to slightly different specifications for the whiskey industry. But then this germinated, dried malt, which is now sweet, and that's important, comes down to Goa. And then what happens then is that it's sort of ground and steeped in liquid, and it becomes this very sugary drink to which yeast is added. And this is why it's important that the starch becomes sugar, because then the yeasts can act on the sugar and make it into alcohol. Right. So basically what the first stage in the distillery, any distillery, is that a very weak sort of beer is made. It's called the wash out of the steeped malt. This very weak beer is what becomes the basis for the distillation.
So what happens after this? How is the liquor distilled? You know, the Scots have this whole legend about their casks, right?
So what happens is this weak beer called the wash goes into the stills, copper stills, and in the Paul John distillery, there are these two big, beautiful copper stills with long necks in which the distillation actually happens. Now, once that happens, and I'm going to say one interesting difference here, which in a way that shows that, you know, Goa is actually more open than Scotland, is there's a very key stage when the raw spirit comes down and goes into the collection vessels. And it goes into something that's called the spirit save. So in Scotland, this is always under lock and key. And it's always a big joke that who has the key can sing. Here in Goa, for the first time in a distillery, I saw the spirit save, which was open. You could just, you know, reach in and taste the raw spirit, which was quite startling for me.
Did you do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just raw spirit. It tasted, I guess, like hand sanitizer. But not that I've drunk hand sanitizer, but anyway.
How would you know?
Yeah. So anyway, the raw spirit then goes into barrels for aging. And this is actually really critical, because this is what makes Scotch what it is. I mean, Scotch originally was just a raw spirit made from barley in Scotland, because barley and oats are pretty much the only thing grains that grow in Scotland. And this raw spirit was made because it was a really cold climate and people needed something to like cheer them up. But it was like our thara. It was just really crude raw spirit. But what people would do is they would store it. Now, if you were a poor person, you would just keep it in a jug or a pail or anything, okay? And it didn't change much. But if you were rich, and Scotland did have all these Scottish barons, they would keep their whiskey in wooden barrels, which were earlier used to store wine. And it's important to realize here that if we remember our history, Scotland has always had a long connection with France. It was Scotland and France as an alliance against the English. So Scotland had all these barrels of really fine wine from France. So the obvious thing was to reuse these barrels by putting the raw spirit in it. And as the sort of aristocracy did this, they realized over time, the spirit inside the barrels changed from something that was really crude to actually something that was quite amazing. And it did this for two reasons. One is simply evaporation. Wooden barrels are porous, so there's always some evaporation that happens. And this evaporation seems to slowly concentrate and mature the whiskey. So that was one thing that happened. And the second was the raw spirit picked up certain flavors from the wood of the barrels. Some flavors are in the wood, you know, things like vanilla or that sort of burnt flavor that comes from the barrel making process. Charcoal notes are picked up. But also some notes were picked up from the previous liquids that were in these barrels, usually wine.
Right.
So this complicated sort of product, you know, part concentrated by evaporation, part picking up flavors from the barrels, is what actually became Scotch whiskey.
The barrels also have a connection with bourbon, right?
So what happens is the raw spirit all goes into barrels that earlier stored bourbon whiskey. Okay, and this comes from the U.S., which makes bourbon whiskey. And for a very weird reason, the world has tons of bourbon barrels. I mean, this is actually one of the strangest labor rights consequences. Way back, I mean, the American whiskey industry, they forced a regulation which said that all bourbon whiskey has to be matured in new oak barrels. And the real reason for this was that they wanted to make sure there was guaranteed employment for the people who worked in the forest industry and the barrel making industry in the US. But the consequence of this is that all bourbon has to go into new oak barrels, which means that there are lots of old barrels. So right. What the bourbon industry did to defray their costs was they started exporting these barrels, which were really nicely seasoned and no longer raw tasting, and to the rest of the world. So Scotland started buying up bourbon barrels. So what happens now is all raw spirit goes into bourbon barrels for aging first. So that's what gives you your base note for Scotch whiskey. Then to finish it, some of it can be used directly. Some of it goes into different types of barrels for port or Madeira or sherry. And this is what master distillers like Michael D'Souza, in the case of Paul John, have to play with. You know, they have whiskey, they have spirit from different ages, young, which is stronger, old, which is more matured and oaky tasting. They have a whiskey from different Madeira, port, or sherry barrels. And all of this they play around with to give you the final product.
Really fascinating. I mean, to think that a regulation intended to protect the jobs of forest workers in the US would have, have an impact on whiskey making in India ages later. Vikram, you went to the visitor center at Paul John's, right? Visitor centers are big business at distilleries, vineyards, and breweries around the world. But this is not a culture that is common to India. You know, tell us, what is a visit to the center like? And do you see this culture catching on here now?
Yeah, right. So as you said, I mean, visitor centers are very important to the alcohol business internationally, because it's obviously a great way in which to promote your alcohol. So all the premium single malt distilleries in Scotland, I mean, in the US, obviously wineries in the US, in France, and, all of them put a lot of emphasis on their visitor centers. So, you know, you can go and have the whole experience, and you can taste, and you can actually buy some of the liquor over there. Now, obviously, this is hugely complicated in India because of all the restrictions we have over selling alcohol.
Right.
But Goa has actually, you know, liberalized this considerably. Maharashtra has too, but only for wineries so far. Goa is the first state, as far as I know, which has allowed a distillery, this distillery, Paul John, to set up a visitor center. And I do know that several other distillers are, you know, quickly trying to set up their own visitor centers. because mm-hmm. this is actually a great opportunity, especially given the sort of tourism that comes to Goa, for them to actually sell the alcohol directly to consumers. You actually get a chance to let visitors see what actually goes into making your alcohol. And obviously, that's a great way to assure visitors that your quality is there. And they can try two or three different types of alcohol and then actually buy it. So I went to the Paul John Visitor Center. It was very impressive. I mean, it's a bit odd because it's set up next to the distillery, which like most distilleries is in an industrial estate. But luckily, this is still Goa, and even the industrial estates are not quite as grim as most industrial estates. So nice. This is in Kunkoli, which is way down in the south of Goa, about half an hour drive to the south of Madgaon. And it's in an area where you have a beautiful view of the Western Ghats.
Right.
And, which is important, actually. Michael, you know, Michael D'Souza told me that the Ghats are important because that's where you get an abundant supply of good quality water, which is essential. And the one thing all distilleries really need is a constant supply of good quality water. And apparently the water in Goa is quite good. So they have plenty of water coming from the... And so this distillery is there. It's a very nice building. It's done by this celebrity architect called Dean De Cruz, who specializes in very traditional sort of forms. It's very open, beautifully ventilated, which is actually useful now in these COVID times because it means that, you know, people can actually go and socially distance a bit.
Thanks.
The distillery, like distilleries across India, it was closed during the hard lockdown. And in fact, the day that I went was just, they told me just the day before, they'd actually sold alcohol for the first time. Because, you know, even though the visitor center is about 2 years old now, I think, they still didn't have the license to sell alcohol. So it was just for presentation purposes. Now, in lockdown, they actually got the final license to sell alcohol. So the day before I came for the first time, they'd actually sold alcohol directly to consumers, which actually is probably path-breaking in India because, you know, through with all our liquor laws, it's impossible for distillers to sell directly to consumers. So this Paul John Center really is pioneering in that way.
Doc, two things you talked about that I want to get to a little bit more. You talked about the water in Goa and you talked about the relatively liberal alcohol laws in Goa. Are these among the factors that have resulted in us seeing a lot of new and trendy alcohol brands emerging out of Goa? You know, we have Stranger and Sons, Greater Than, Hapusa, John's, of course. You know, we have beers like White Owl, which are, you know, brewing in Goa in significant quantities.
Absolutely. And, you know, actually the difference is more at the retail end than at the manufacturing end. Mm-hmm. I think what Paul John shows is that it's actually not that difficult to make high quality alcohol if you're willing to spend a bit more. But, you know, manufacturing is just one problem. The other problem is retailing. And India, the state laws over alcohol make retailing extremely, extremely complicated. So, yes, Goa has the most liberal laws in India for manufacturing. I think more than the laws, it's simply the fact that it's a small state. So what most of these alcohol companies have told me is that it made the process of getting the licenses much easier. Of course, there's also the fact that Goa wants to encourage tourism and tourism is linked to alcohol consumption. But all that apart, the real difference, I think, is actually being able to retail it. Because, you know, across India, people can make good quality alcohol. For instance, many people have tried making high quality alcohol in Himachal, Uttaranchal, but, you know, because the water is there, the barley is there, everything, it's like Scotland. But the problems with selling it are so high that it doesn't make any sense. Whereas Goa, the real revolution has been in liberalizing retail sales for alcohol. I mean, the one thing that really freaks people out is, you know, people come with the memory of dry days and having always to keep track of, you know, what is there. Even Maharashtra, which is relatively liberal, has this complicated systems of, you know, religious holidays and Ekadashis and all that. And every, you know, half the time when you want to go out and buy alcohol, you'll find it shut. Goa, as far as I know, just one holiday, which is on Gandhi Jayanti, 2nd October. Otherwise, you can buy alcohol through the year. I mean, people come here for, you know, long weekends on 26th January or 15th August, and, you know, they tell people who are here like me, oh, please make sure that you're going to buy alcohol in advance. And we say, you know, but you can go to the shops on 15th August or 26th January and buy alcohol. And it freaks people out. The only holidays are Gandhi Jayanti and election days. Yeah, I think those are the only holidays for alcohol sales in Goa.
Vikram, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks.
That was the voice of Vikram Doctor, an ET features writer and one of India's most knowledgeable people on food and drink. Today, he took us on a riveting journey through the world of barleys, malts, barrels and master craftsmen. And perhaps we can raise a toast to the singular achievement by John Distilleries and Michael D'Souza, its master distiller. That's it from us today on The Morning Brief. This is Shrudijit from The Economic Times. This episode was edited and coordinated by Anjali Venugopalan. The Morning Brief appears Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays every week. You can write to us with feedback on themorningbrief@timesgroup.com. Goodbye, and I hope you have a nice day ahead.
Awaaz.com